Donald Trump Jr. on Capitol Hill today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's eldest son defended his meeting with a Russian lawyer last year, saying he did not collude. And here's a safe prediction. Donald Jr.'s appearance on the Hill won't be the last we hear about this.
The Russia probe is just going to be constantly running in the background of whatever Republicans on Capitol Hill would rather be talking about.
Also, Hurricane Irma continues to cut a path of destruction through the Caribbean. People on the sister islands of Antigua and Barbuda are already assessing the damage.
Just thinking about the devastation throughout the Caribbean, the other islands, this one is for the history books.
Plus, how a Jewish folk song made its way into a Japanese video game called Sexy Parodius. Trust me on this one and stick around. It's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World on a Thursday. Back to school day here in Boston and back to the Hill this week for lawmakers in Washington. That's where we start today with the latest from our nation's capital on the various Russia investigations. Donald Trump Jr. was in D.C. today for a closed-door meeting with Senate investigators looking into, possible links between the Trump campaign and Russia last year. So the late summer headlines may be about racial tensions, hurricanes, and a possible war with North Korea. But look for Russia to come back into focus as Congress kicks back into high gear. Betsy Woodruff is a political reporter at The Daily Beast. Just remind us briefly, Betsy, what happened with the investigations this summer.
What we've learned is that there are multiple investigations going on. There are multiple investigations on Capitol Hill, and there have been recent reports, which I can confirm, that Bob Mueller, who's the special counsel running the Justice Department's investigation of the alleged collusion, has teamed up and done a bit of coordination with Eric Schneiderman, who's the Attorney General of the state of New York. I also reported last week, or the week before, hard to remember, they all run together. Mueller has been working with agents from the IRS's Criminal Investigations Division. That means it's highly likely he's investigating evidence that someone associated with the president may have committed a tax crime, potentially of money laundering or tax evasion.
And what is the significance of Mueller teaming up with the New York State Attorney General?
So Eric Schneiderman cannot be fired by Donald Trump. He works for the state of New York, not for the federal government. Additionally, if Schneiderman finds that Trump or one of his associates violated New York state law, the president won't have the power to pardon one of his associates for that. The president's pardon powers only apply to federal law here in the United States. So Schneiderman is insulated from some of the pressure that Mueller faces. And theoretically, that means that if the president took an extraordinary step, which we know he's comfortable with taking extraordinary steps, and fired Mueller, that it's possible Mueller could sort of pass the baton to Schneiderman. Mm. It gives Mueller something of an extra insurance policy.
So with lawmakers returning from summer recess, how would you describe the narrative of Russia-Trump connections at this point and where lawmakers pick up the baton in the investigation?
It's increasingly tricky for Republicans to talk about. Just this morning, Don Jr., the president's son, testified behind closed doors to some Senate staffers, confirming in a situation where lying would be unlawful that he did have communications knowingly with someone who he understood to be an intermediary for the Russian government in hopes of getting information that would damage Hillary Clinton. Now that Congress is back, we're probably going to see more activity on the Hill as more of Trump's associates go in for these behind-closed-door question-and-answer sessions, and the Russia probe is just going to be constantly running in the background.
So aside from Donald Trump Jr., which members of Trump's White House team are currently under investigation?
Jared Kushner is the one who seems to have the most legal liability. Of course, he is the husband of Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, and he is a White House staffer. We know that he did not reveal that meeting last summer that Don Jr. had. Jared was in that meeting as well. The fact that he didn't reveal that meeting when he applied for a security clearance is something that has lawyers close to the president concerned. Outside the White House, of course, a number of former Trump associates have had to lawyer up. General Mike Flynn, who was the national security advisor to the president for a short time. We also know that Paul Manafort has faced a ton of scrutiny from federal investigators. Manafort, of course, was the CEO of Trump's campaign for a short time.
There are several committees in both the House and Senate that are holding private hearings in the next few months. Can you just break down what they're focusing on? Are they all focused on different aspects of the Trump-Russia collusion?
One thing that's important to remember is that one silo of the investigation is looking into the possibility that crimes were committed, a criminal investigation. And then another side of the investigation is actually a counterintelligence investigation. So the intelligence committees, both in the House and in the Senate, it's likely their focus is actually figuring out what specific acts we can attribute potentially to Russian government actors. Meanwhile, the judiciary committees that are also looking into this are going to be focusing more on the thorny legal questions.
So, Betsy, what are you going to be keeping your eye on in the coming weeks with these investigations?
It's really hard to narrow down. There's a lot going on. One thing to keep an eye out for is if more members of the White House start to lawyer up. We know that the Mueller probe is sort of widening its scope and that it's likely they'll be questioning a number of senior White House officials. Those folks are all going to need attorneys. And when that happens, that'll be a good indicator of just how wide the probe is. And of course, what can we understand about the nature of the investigation based on the folks that Mueller's working with?
That's Betsy Woodruff, political reporter at The Daily Beast. The congressional committees investigating Russia's meddling in the U.S. election got another update this week, this one from Facebook. The company found that hundreds of fake accounts, likely operated by a Russian company that has links to the Kremlin, spent $100,000 to post political ads on the platform. That was before and after the 2016 presidential election here in the U.S. For more on this, we've got Yakub Yanda. He heads the Kremlin Watch Program, which is all about tracking Russian disinformation campaigns aimed at Western governments. So, Mr. Yanda, there's a lot of information we don't know yet about these Facebook ads, but from a tactical standpoint, does this look like an approach that Russian state actors would take to spread false information?
Much definitely, it looks like that way. Actually, we have seen Russian government and its proxies spreading massive disinformation against Western democracies in order to interfere in the elections, like in the US or in France, or in general into try to sway public opinion.
Yeah, what specifically are the hallmarks of the strategy that suggests to you Russia's behind this?
Well, there is clear evidence that Russian authorities actually employ people in so-called troll farms, so basically state-run proxy companies, which are creating disinformation on Facebook, or they are trying to make the comment section toxic, so creating basically propaganda, so clear lies, or trying to sway comment section or discussions on Facebook on Twitter. So that's clear that basically Russia is doing it today. The question is how much of it is it doing? And that's what we don't know, at least in the public domain.
What's kind of interesting, this is according to Facebook, they say that most of these ads were not directed at a specific candidate, and the vast majority of them didn't even reference the election. Instead, they focused on divisive hot button issues here in the U.S. like gay rights or gun ownership or immigration. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, this is, again, something what we can see Russia doing in general. They have two levels of the game they are playing at a single time. One is short-term looking at the elections, so trying to attack single candidates. And the long-term game would be really trying to sway public opinion or make even worse the current situation in this specific country. So, for example, if you are having domestic grievances and domestic political fights over specific social or political issue, this is something what the Kremlin would like to make even worse by those means, such as creating disinformation on this topic, such as, for example, a migration wave and political Islam in Europe. For example, those are hot topics which Russia is trying to make worse. And by this, they can basically create the impression that everything is all falling apart. And those candidates, which Russia considers to be more preferable, such as Donald Trump during the campaign, or let's say Marine Le Pen in France, those would maybe benefit from such situation.
Are you able to track cause and effect from all this? Like, because Facebook sold ads to Russian companies, X number of votes went to Donald Trump.
Well, we are not, actually. Not only ourselves, but basically the expert community in the West isn't able, and honestly, it's technically and methodologically impossible. But actually, if you look at the case study of the U.S. presidential election last year, honestly, the impact of Russian disinformation could have had the impact on the overall result. The elections were so close that it's really considerable how much of the Russian impact it could have had.
Yakub Yanda is head of the Kremlin Watch Program and deputy director at the European Values Think Tank in Prague. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Next week will mark 3 months since the Grenfell Tower fire in London. British police say at least 80 people died in the horrific blaze that engulfed the high-rise apartment tower. One of the victims was 24-year-old Khadija Say. She was a British Gambian artist and photographer. Just a month before the fire, Say's career had a huge break. Some of her photographs were included in a show at the Venice Biennale. It was a compelling series of self-portraits where she used old photo techniques to explore traditional Gambian spiritual practices. After the blaze, one of those portraits was hung at the Tate Britain Gallery in London as a memorial to her and the fire's other victims. My colleague John Wilson with BBC's Radio 4 had a wonderful remembrance of Khadija Say on a show, and I want to share some of that with you now. Wilson spoke with Say's artistic mentor, Nicola Green, and curator, David Bailey. Here's Bailey explaining why he chose Khadija's work for the Venice Biennale.
She was young in age, but her spirit was very mature and very old, in a sense, like a kind of wise, old kind of spiritual sage. So I think what drew most of us was how generous in spirit Khadija was in terms of wanting to be open about risk taken in the work, which is very difficult at this level, and at the same time really using, mining all of that to think about producing a body of work based on a very old, antiquated form of photography process.
And all of these photographs are self-portraits. She's posing, isn't she, in that series? The one at the Tate, she has her back to the camera. It's a beautiful black and white faded image. And she's holding a bunch of sticks. What are they? What do they represent?
Well, I think, for me, I think the question has to be, how is it possible to make work that is so historically and culturally rooted when we're so bombarded by social media about all these things about globalization? And I think she's taken that and thought, well, actually, I'm going to really focus on my cultural tradition and really kind of interpret 21st century modern techniques and go back and refer. Because you have to remember, photography was the precursor to, you know, the movement of where we are in the 21st century in terms of image making.
And Nicola, you have mentored her. You worked so closely with her for 3 years. When did you first see her work? Well, what was it about it that attracted your attention?
Well, I met her 3 years ago when I'd been asked to be a judge on the Discerning Eye exhibition. And I was able to choose artists and curate a wall. And I had not met her at the time that I saw her work. And she'd submitted for this competition a series of six photographic images from her series called Crowned, which are celebrating and exploring the power of black women through images of their hair.
Yeah, yeah. And they're all shot from above, aren't they?
They're all shot from above. And I was very taken and moved by these pieces that I put in the centre of the wall. And she came to the opening of the exhibition and with her mother, Mary, and she was so proud. It was her first exhibition after having graduated from college. And she talked to me about how she was going to pursue a career and what that was going to take, and how she was working as a care assistant at the time and in a care home at the time. And she talked about you know, the difficulties of moving into the art world and making work and affording to make work, and how that would happen.
And she didn't have a studio as such, did she? Worked at home at Grenfell Tower?
Yes.
She worked in her home in Grenfell Tower.
And that's actually that's where she was developing the photographs.
She was developing her photographs, and actually this work that she exhibited in the Diaspora Pavilion was taken. She used relics from her mother's Gambian tradition, and this work is really an exploration of her faith and from, you know, a very personal context in the relationship that she had with her mother.
Khadija Say and her mother, Mary Mendy, both died in the Grenfell Tower blaze in June in London. We were listening there to artist Nicola Green and before that curator David Bailey, remembering what made Khadija Say and her photographs so special. They were speaking with my colleague John Wilson on the BBC's Radio 4. Coming up, whatever happened with that refugee agreement with Australia that Trump called a dumb deal? The answer, just ahead, here on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Remember that famous phone call between President Trump and Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull? It happened in January, just a few days after Trump was inaugurated. It was supposed to be one of those pro forma, hi, how you doing, courtesy calls to a close ally. But it ended up being a tense 24-minute exchange. Their nerves frayed in that call over an Obama-era deal with Australia that obliges the U.S. to resettle up to 2,000 asylum-seeking refugees being held in deeply controversial offshore Australian-run detention camps. There are many layers to this story, and now there are some important updates to it. The World's Carol Hills is here. So you've been following the story of these refugees on these two island detention camps for a while now, Carol. What's the latest? What happened?
Well, just a reminder about why Australia has offshore detention camps. It has this policy whereby it won't accept asylum seekers who arrive by boat. So Australian officials, I think they use the military now, intercept boats carrying refugees, and they take them directly to one of two offshore detention camps. Australia won't accept people who arrive by boat. So they'll either end up on the tiny island of Nauru, it's in the Pacific, at a camp there, for families and children, or on Manus Island, which is part of Papua New Guinea. It's a men's only camp, and that's the camp I'm talking about today.
So what happened?
Well, what happened is a couple different things. A couple days ago, a court in Australia approved of a settlement. It's a class action human rights case that was brought by current detainees and past detainees of the Manus Island camp against the Australian government for illegal detention and negligence. So the government of Australia wanted to settle, and they offered the settlement to the court, and it was just approved. It's about $56 million American, but it affects a lot of present and past detainees. So the actual amount that the detainees will get is maybe $40,000. But more importantly, the financial settlement does nothing to determine where they'll actually end up. Some have been languishing at this camp for 4 years. How are they even going to get the money? They're not allowed to even set up a bank account. They're still stuck in Papua New Guinea without a solution to their eventual status, what third country they're going to end up in. And the other thing that's going on is that the country of Papua New Guinea, its own Supreme Court has ruled that this detention camp, which Australia pays it to run, is unconstitutional. And so they are going to shut down this detention camp at the end of October. And so these men have nowhere to go, and what's going to happen to them?
Now, in that phone call I was mentioning earlier between Prime Minister Turnbull in Australia and Trump, Trump really showed no inclination to take in any of these refugees, even though that was part of the deal, up to 2,000 of these refugees. Eventually, he did honor the agreement. What changed?
Well, he had to. It was a bilateral agreement. Australia agreed in exchange to resettle asylum seekers from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, people who are in a U.S.-run detention camp in Costa Rica. And so that agreement is in place. But Papua New Guinea, the country that's hosting the Manus Island camp, says they want to shut down the camp by October 31st. Their own Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea ruled that the camp is unconstitutional. And so what's going to happen to all these men in this camp? There's about 700 of them have asylum status, but they have not been either accepted into the U.S. or a third country. So what's going to happen to them?
You followed and reported on the cases of two of the detainees at Manus Island. How are they doing?
Well, there's two people I focused on in my reporting. One is a cartoonist named Eaton Fish. That's his pen name. He's from Iran. And he does not have asylum status. So his future is completely uncertain. He suffers from a lot of psychiatric issues and medical issues. And currently, I just found out today, he is in Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea, getting care. It's just not clear what's going to happen to him. He's still cartooning, and there's a big effort among cartoonists to help him and have Australia take him in. The other person that we've reported on, his name is Aziz Mohammed. He's originally from Sudan, and he's been at this camp in Manus Island for more than 4 years.
Wow.
I spoke this morning to a reporter in Australia who is in touch with him all the time via text message and WhatsApp. And Aziz initially was excited about the financial settlement, but has now realized it doesn't solve his status. And he's stuck. And he has asylum status. And so far, he has not been interviewed by U.S. authorities.
Yes. So what happens with the resettlement process for, like, these two men?
It's unclear. And it's unclear for everyone there. I was in touch with various government officials in the U.S. about how the resettlement process is going. And they've made a number of visits. People have been interviewed. But no one has been chosen yet to be resettled in the U.S.
The World's Carol Hills. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's another story that centers on a humanitarian crisis and refugee camps, the exodus of Rohingyas from Myanmar to refugee camps in Bangladesh. Some 150,000 of them have already crossed the border. The Rohingyas are a Muslim minority in Myanmar, the country also known as Burma, and the Rohingyas blame the Burmese government for the violence that's driving them from their homes. The government rejects that accusation. My BBC colleague Sanjoy Majumdar met some Rohingya refugees on the Bangladeshi side of the border.
There's a big crowd of refugees who've just come in and have basically collapsed on the side of the road, sitting on their sacks, their possessions. Many of them look completely exhausted, weak, and very hungry. I'm just inside a refugee camp that's just been built by the side of a hill. Rows and rows of tents, nothing more than plastic sheets stretched and tied between two trees, propped up by bamboo poles. It's filled with people. There's a young man here. He looks to be about 18 or 19. Naam ki tumar?
Amin. Aste 3 din lagte.
My name is Amin. I came 3 days ago. We were hiding in the mountains. My village was attacked. My house set on fire by the army and Buddhist mobs. There was gunfire everywhere. We were able to escape, but my father and grandmother went inside the house. They died.
This is why so many Rohingyas are coming into Bangladesh, a Muslim nation where they are welcomed and they feel secure. Several boats have just come ashore on the beach along the southeastern Bangladesh coast. Large wooden fishing boats, all of them filled to capacity with Rohingya refugees. One of them's listing dangerously to one side as they start jumping off one after the other. The men, and now they're reaching in to help the women. They look absolutely shattered. It's difficult to independently verify what's happening inside Myanmar. Access is severely restricted. The government there blames the violence on Rohingya militant groups, something that this local villager corroborates, although she was speaking in the presence of military officers.
Muslim men destroyed the pagoda with heavy weapons and chopped the Buddha statue with swords. We could not stay in our village. We have no arms, while they have large weapons.
The Rohingyas are sometimes described as the world's most persecuted minority, denied citizenship of Myanmar despite living there for generations. There is now a visible growing anger.
All we want is to be given citizenship of Myanmar, nothing more. It is our country. But the Buddhists want to drive us out and ensure that not a single Muslim is left, and the army is helping them to do this.
Fear has driven the Rohingyas out of Myanmar. But there are many who worry that their insecurity could quite easily turn militant and lead to radicalism.
The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar reporting there from Bangladesh.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Wealthy Russians are coming to Florida to give birth. And they're staying at President Trump's properties when they're there.
There's certainly a sort of reverence for this self-made man narrative that Trump projects. This American multi-billionaire who built these buildings that you can stay in.
Birth tourism, a growth industry. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You can't miss the dire headlines warning of Hurricane Irma's perilous path toward Florida. And by the way, people in Florida and elsewhere, I hope you're taking the warnings and evacuation seriously. Florida Governor Rick Scott said today that the state will not be able to save people once the storm hits. First, you might have missed that Irma has already caused significant damage on American soil in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Stacey Plaskett represents the U.S. territory in Congress. We reached her on Capitol Hill. She says the storm hit the territory with destructive force.
The roof of the Schneider Hospital on St. Thomas was gone, and they've evacuated patients from the hospital. on the island of St. Thomas, St. John, and we're assessing Water Island, there has been massive loss of property. FEMA has been doing a tremendous job, along with our local emergency management agencies. There are Navy ships that are on their way, but the damage is tremendous to property. We do know of some casualties, and we will be assessing that as we move along. 911, our emergency management system, is down, and so individuals are posting things online, and then ham radios and other types of radio in which people are able to communicate information. Our hotels have had sustained damage as well. The airports have been cleared, and they're using that to have cargo ships and others bring emergency equipment to the people on those islands.
In your time down there, Congresswoman, have you ever had to face a time horizon after a catastrophe like this of many years?
Yes. In 1989, with Hurricane Hugo, which was Category 4, it took 3 years was the time frame for the recovery. This was a Category 5. I have to tell you, though, that we have been enormously prepared for this. Despite the level of destruction that we've seen, we had first Hurricane Hugo on St. Croix in 1989, Hurricane Marilyn in 95 on St. Thomas and St. John. And so most of our homes and buildings were within hurricane code. But because of the force of Hurricane Irma, which we know has devastated our neighbor islands of the British Virgin Islands, along with Antigua, Barbuda, Anguilla, and some of those others, Hurricane Irma came within 20, 40 miles, the eye, on the island, the north side of St. Thomas, which meant that they were receiving winds 150 plus miles per hour, which is the reason why even within code, we were not able to keep all of the buildings and structures in place. What we're also concerned about, of course, is because Hurricane Jose is right around the horizon. That's making its way across the Atlantic and heading in the same path that Irma was to the Caribbean. And we're, concerned that those buildings that are there or the buildings that are exposed, that we're able to recover them before and secure them before Jose hits landfall, even if it's just heavy rains, we know that that's going to provide additional damage to an already fragile area.
You know, there's been so much media attention on when and where Irma might land in Florida or on the eastern seaboard hitting landfall in the United States. Does it bother you that so many people don't realize Irma already landed in the U.S. on American soil when it hit the Virgin Islands, not to mention Puerto Rico?
Yes, you know, it's difficult to hear the discussions in some of our news outlets where they focus the attention solely on the continental U.S., talking about what's going to happen with Florida, when other parts of the United States, namely the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, have already been decimated by this hurricane. Antigua, Barbuda, the British Virgin Islands, Tortola, Anegada, all the other places which have already seen the devastation and now need the support and the encouragement to move forward. Our governor has said that he, of course, wanted to be thankful, let the Virgin Islanders know that while we are fighting for equal rights, the ability to vote, we are also thankful as American citizens that we have FEMA, that our president has really stepped up. He's received personal phone calls from him. I've received phone calls from the White House, NSC, FEMA, State Department, and others, just expressing their support and trying to really get moving on how we can bring provision. So for that, we're grateful.
Congresswoman Stacey Plaskett, the delegate for the U.S. Virgin Islands in the House of Representatives, thank you very much for your time and the best of luck.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
The small Caribbean nation of Antigua and Barbuda was right in the crosshairs of Irma. Here's Antigua and Barbuda Prime Minister Gaston Brown describing the situation on Barbuda.
From my observation, having done an aerial survey, I would say that about 95% of the properties would have suffered some level of damage. It is absolutely heart-wrenching.
Yeah, 95%. Angelica O'Donohue is the editor of the Antigua Chronicle. Antigua is Barbuda's sister island. So, Angelica, what have the last 24 hours been like for you at the Chronicle?
It's been absolutely horrendous and overwhelming at the same time. I mean, with all this tragedy that's been happening, on the other hand, the outpour of love and assistance has been overwhelming. People are asking, calling, how is it we can help Barbuda? How is it we can help Antigua? What is it that we need most? And most of all, we just need to get Barbudans out of Barbuda. it's just been announced we're now on the hurricane watch for Hurricane Jose. So that's just another headache that we have to deal with right now.
Yeah, I mean, Antigua and Barbuda, so close together. I mean, they are sister islands, and on a clear day, you can see each island from the other. What's the difference in damage between Antigua and Barbuda? I mean, what do you attribute that to?
Mother Nature playing a game on us. Being throughout the hurricane, okay, we were like, yeah, we can feel the winds. It's pretty scary outside. And then you wake up in the morning and look around, and you're like, okay, minimal damage. Not many houses were destroyed. There's a few downpours. A few trees were down. Nothing much. And then you think, you know what? It might probably be the same situation over there in Barbuda. But for the entire day yesterday and the day before, we could not communicate with Barbuda. We had no idea what was happening. Not even the ham phones were working. None of the cell phone providers were working. It was absolute panic and chaos. And then you listen to the news report and you realize that Barbuda got the brunt of it. The eye of that horrible, disastrous storm, they had to face it on their own. And finally, when our prime minister was able to travel yesterday afternoon and he came back home and he described the situation over there, we saw the first images, the entire country was just in utter disbelief. It is a vast contrast between here in Antigua, which is a much bigger island. We have far more resources compared to Barbuda, who actually had really good housing structures in terms of how they were building their homes. They use a lot of concrete with their homes. So to see that type of damage compared to us, who use a lot of wood, it's a vast, vast, vast contrast.
Yeah, it's just the fluke of Mother Nature, as you say. Do you have any friends and family on Barbuda?
That's correct. Friends and family, young family.
And are you
young cousin?
Are you in contact with them now?
No, no one is in contact with anyone in Barbuda. The cell tower is literally bent in half.
Wow. What is the biggest need for people in Antigua and Barbuda right now?
Well, one, to get them out of Barbuda. Two, it'd be relief efforts. So just whatever contributions you can make, whether it be clothing items, clean bottled water, hygiene products, baby supplies, all of the necessities you would need in wake of a disaster.
And as you said, you're now preparing for Hurricane Jose, which is right behind Irma. I mean, how do you do that when you've just gone through one hurricane and things are damaged pretty severely?
You continue to prepare. Honestly, no one has taken down their hurricane shutters or the boards. All of the homes across the islands are still pretty much boarded up. We were kind of sort of preparing ourselves from the moment we heard, okay, there's another system developing out in the Atlantic. I think majority of Antiguans decided, you know what, let us just leave the homes as they are, fix what you can fix, but prepare for the absolute worst. And that's what we're doing right now.
And as to the historic nature of Hurricane Irma, have you ever seen anything like this in Antigua?
To be honest, no. We tried to compare it to Hurricane Lewis. Hurricane Lewis happened in 1995. I was only 8 years old, but I can distinctly remember the chaos that brought, and that was just a Category 4, I believe. It took a while for Antigua and Barbuda to get back on our feet after that hurricane. So before the hurricane, Hurricane Irma came, we were like, okay, yeah, it might possibly be like that. Now that she has left us, although she has left us in an all right stage, just thinking about the devastation throughout the Caribbean, the other islands, this one is for the history books.
Angelica O'Donoghue, the editor of the Antigua Chronicle. We wish you safety and good luck in the days ahead. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now to a story from Florida with no hurricane connection, a story about an unusual Trump-Russia connection. I'm looking at a glitzy video ad featuring images of Trump Tower in Miami, bathrooms with gold fixtures. There are ocean views and a fireplace, huge ceilings and white glove service, all yours for tens of thousands of dollars a month. The ad is targeted at a very specific clientele, Russians who want to come to Miami to have their babies and get U.S. citizenship for the kids in the process. That's according to a new story in the Daily Beast. Katie Zavadsky wrote it.
So we're talking about wealthy Russians who can afford to take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to come hang out on Florida beaches, rent an apartment, pay out of pocket for top-tier medical care, and have their babies here.
And what's the benefit of giving birth in Florida, in Miami?
Yeah, so mothers list a couple of reasons. First, the medical care is a lot better here than in Russia in many cases, especially in the way that we treat pregnant women and in terms of postpartum care. And of course, the weather is a lot better in Miami than in many parts of Russia, especially in certain times of year. But certainly one of the most important benefits is that the children get an American passport, which enables them to come work in the U.S. when they're adults. It enables them to come to school in the U.S. and, more importantly, to travel the world freely and not have the sorts of visa restrictions that Russian citizens also often have.
Right. And that's without exception. If you're born in the United States, you get a U.S. passport, right?
Absolutely.
So this is not something that happens ad hoc. There are actually companies, agencies that offer packages for wealthy Russian families to do this. And a lot of these agencies seem to guide these families to stay in Trump properties. Do these agencies use exclusively Trump properties?
So, yes, there's this huge business of birth tourism companies that are targeting, in this case, tourists from Russia and the post-Soviet space. But, you know, other companies target other parts of the world. They're not necessarily exclusively advertising Trump properties, but certainly for their wealthiest tier of clients, the people who can afford to shell out $80,000, $85,000 for just a few months in Florida, those people are being offered very expensive apartments in Trump Towers and Trump Royale and places like that.
There does seem to be a kind of respect for Trump in Russia among some of the wealthy there. Is the fact that you would stay in one of these Trump properties for several months, is that a draw?
I think certainly when we look at forums when this is being discussed, people are really drawn to the Trump buildings. They're some of the buildings that are discussed most often. And then when you look at the sorts of people who are checking in there and tagging themselves, a lot of times what you'll see is a Russian tourist of any stripe sort of checking in and saying, "Here I am at the Trump Tower." I saw one of the birth tourism companies sort of touts Trump as like this American multi-billionaire who built these buildings that you can stay in himself. And there's certainly a sort of reverence for this self-made man narrative that Trump projects.
So how long has this been a thing for Russians going to Florida to give birth? And roughly how many families are we talking about a year?
This is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for, I would say, the better part of a decade. It's hard to quantify on many different accounts. Some people go on their own, and that is sort of the burgeoning middle-class birth tourism, going in and trying to get the sort of the lower level of birth tourism. And then what we have is companies who are really catering to people who can afford to pay someone else to arrange that. And an estimate that one of the proprietors of those companies gave was 40 to 60 births a month just in Florida through these companies. But this is also happening in California, in Salt Lake City, in New York.
So bottom line, is the Trump organization profiting from this Russian anchor baby business? And does that imply a conflict of interest for the White House?
So, yes, there are two levels of Trump properties that birth tourists can visit or stay at in Florida. And one of those are the condos, the Trump Towers, the Trump Palace, the Trump Royale, where the money is not necessarily going directly into the Trump organization. But one of the most popular destinations, in part because it lets you stay somewhere more affordable and then still vacation in the Trump name, is the Trump International Beach Resort, which is still owned and operated by the Trump organization. And certainly they are making money off of that.
How has the Trump organization responded to all of this?
I reached out to them for comment and haven't heard back yet.
Katie Zavadsky of The Daily Beast joining us from New York. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of Olympic coverage last year during the Games in Rio de Janeiro focused not just on events, but also a disease, Zika, and the mosquitoes that spread the virus. Meanwhile, there was this whole other mosquito-related Olympic story that we missed. Here's the quick version. Sprinter Anyika Onwuru was a bronze medalist in Rio with the British 4x400 relay team, but just 10 months before that, she couldn't even walk. Her nightmare began when, way before the Games, she flew to Nigeria to visit family. Pretty soon, she started noticing some weird symptoms, which she promptly reported to her British athletics doctor.
I was emailing them, the doctor, and I said, you know, my urine is dark, like really, really dark. And he was like, are you sure it's not alcohol or you haven't been drinking it, like drinking water, staying hydrated? And I'm always hydrated. Even in the off season, you still got to look after your body. And I was like, no, it seems quite worrying. And then when I got back, he said, you know, let's test your urine and, like, let's get a blood test and stuff like that. And then within 12 hours, he got back to me and he said, you know, there's something wrong with your kidneys.
Turns out she had malaria. She was put under quarantine and eventually lost the ability to walk.
The fact that you have to start learning how to walk, like putting one foot in front of the other, that's crazy. Something that you've been doing your whole life. You know, I wasn't able to do that. And then as soon as I could walk, I could basically start running again.
Hey, when you're a sprinter, you go for speed, right? And your recovery routine is anything but routine.
And then I'd start doing build-ups and just taking it day by day and then start doing my big workouts again. And I was like, no matter how much it killed, like doing all those big lactic sessions, I was just so grateful.
Grateful and on her way to an Olympic bronze medal. British sprinter Anyika Onwuara speaking. And finally today... This is Mayim Mayim, an early 20th century Jewish folk song. The lyrics come from the biblical book of Isaiah, from a chapter celebrating water. Mayim Mayim literally means water, water. Decades ago, the kibbutz community in Israel embraced the tune. Now you can hear it across the world at summer camps and Hebrew schools, and also in Japanese video games. So how exactly did this old world Jewish folk song make its way into the video game world? The world's Brandy Fullwood looked into that for our series, Future Folk.
In 1996, when Konami released Sexy Parodius, I was only 2 years old. By that time, the Japanese entertainment company had already released games like Frogger and Metal Gear, games my parents and brother were more impressed by. The Sexy Parodius soundtrack includes a song called Lovely Otomia, and it may sound familiar. Listen to this. That's Mayim Mayim, and it's prominently looped into the soundtrack. Last month, Tablet, an American Jewish magazine, published an article about Mayim Mayim being a big hit in Japanese video game soundtracks. According to the article, during the American occupation, a folk and square dance educator by the name of Ricky Holden was enlisted to teach folk dances in Taiwan and Japan from 1957 to 58. So... I started to look into Mayim Mayim's earlier presence in Japan, but much of the information from the 20th century is a mess of Great Depression runoff, rampant xenophobia, World War II paranoia, oil crises, and the global purge of religion from the Bolshevik Revolution to the Holocaust. After looping in and out of my own conclusions, trying to scrounge up early 20th century documents, I came up short, and so I made a call.
Japanese have always been really fascinated by Jews.
That's Mary White, a professor of anthropology and a specialist in contemporary Japanese culture at Boston University.
To be Jewish in Japan is sometimes to be the object of very friendly curiosity. They're certainly seen as high-class ethnics, smart, civil, having a strong sense of the importance of society.
Well, beyond the fact that Jewish refugees are led into Japan.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last thing you said.
I found myself talking in circles because my head and heart set an agenda based on what I was able to find about Japan's relationship to cultural preservation and Judaism. Just before the Holocaust, a Japanese diplomat in Lithuania named Chiyun Sugihara signed between 6,000 to 10,000 exit visas for Jews fleeing Poland. It's nicknamed the Fugu Plan. A large portion of the people ended up settling in Japan, and I wanted it to be the reason Mayim Mayim made its way into Japan. Mary let me know otherwise.
When I was first in Japan in 1963, there was a pretty strong Jewish community in Tokyo and one in Kobe. But those communities are small and do not represent the influence of Jewish culture in Japan, which goes way beyond the actual Jews who live in Japan.
So maybe it wasn't widespread from Jewish refugees, but Mary also suggested that post-World War II occupation is a safe answer. Japan had spent more than 250 years in isolation in its Edo period, and when that ended, the country was eager to learn about the rest of the world.
Right from the very beginning of the Meiji period in 1868, there were the introduction of Western and other folk cultures.
The Meiji period ends in 1912, and Maim Maim's composer, Emmanuel Amaran, would have been three. Meiji might have ended, but curiosity didn't.
People were fascinated. In the 1920s, there was a lot of this going on in the schools.
I wondered if the song itself reached Japan in the 1920s, if later in the 30s the kibbutz communities were able to reach Japan, if Japan's pursuit of learning world culture brought Maim Maim into the country slightly before World War II.
Folk dance has always been done in Japan. It is not only after the occupation, during the occupation, that it was introduced.
So, it's possible that Maim Maim made its way into Japan well before the post-war occupation. But proving that is difficult if you consider the context. Preserving Jewish culture during the mid-20th century was its own covert operation, as it was ill-advised or illegal. So how did Maim Maim end up in the video game, and why? Well, if most people in Japan, if not all, danced to Maim Maim in gym class as a result of the Meiji period and the influence of the occupation, putting Maim Maim in a video game is just, well, nostalgic. Maybe. For The World, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Brandy's story is part of our series Future Folk, a co-production with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. And that'll do it for us today. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston.
Public Radio International.